Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the country's healthcare system could change under the Trump administration.
And we meet Miss Mermaid Arizona and learn about the multi-million dollar world of mermaiding.
But first, both major party candidates in last year's presidential election proposed getting rid of federal taxes on tips workers earn. And this week, state lawmakers will consider a similar idea on the state level. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to preview the week ahead at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. So where's my tip?
Well, here's a good tip. You should keep coming on the show Monday mornings.
Oh, I like it.
So is this basically exactly what it sounds like? Workers who earn tips would not have to pay taxes, state taxes on those tips?
That's exactly it. I mean, in some ways, this is a mirror of the federal proposal that Mr. Trump had trotted out. Then, obviously, the Democrats went, me too. It seems to have a certain popularity with the idea that folks who are working for tips are probably at the bottom end of the income scale. If you want to go ahead and provide some sort of relief, the way to do it is with eliminating taxes. Now, obviously, it's a much bigger impact on the federal level. I mean, state tax rate is 2.5%, and that's of your adjusted income. So we're not talking about large amounts of money here, but it's a philosophical thing that should you be doing this? Now, obviously, there are issues there, not the least of which is whether it can be gamed. Some Democrats were complaining that, look, so let's say you're a doctor or a professional, and you arrange to have your fees, quote unquote, paid in tips. Mm-hmm. Now, can you shield $50,000, $60,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 as tips from the people that you were helping? Interesting question. And when they try to put a limit on it in terms of the dollars, the Republicans said, nope, not going to do it.
Well, so Howie, this will be coming up for what's called a third read, basically yay or nay on the big board in the House later today. Has this had bipartisan support so far? Has it mostly been Republicans supporting it?
It's mostly been Republican support here in Arizona, but again, given that Democrats don't like to be seen as going against poor people, that's part of the reason what they did is they tried to put on that floor amendment to say, well, there should be some limits on this, and then that way we can all feel comfortable. Their excuse could be now, well, you didn't put any limits on this, so why should we vote for this?
All right. So, Howie, also later today, a Senate committee will be taking up a bill that would essentially lease the state prison in Marana to the federal government for a buck per year. Is that right?
Exactly. This is designed to deal with a couple of things. The Marana prison is vacant. It was originally built as kind of a lease purchase arrangement and run by a private contractor. They don't need it anymore. They don't have any inmates in there. And so they figure, okay, we can sort of kill two birds with one stone. We can have somebody in there maintaining it and making it useful. And the feds, they presume, are going to be looking for a place to house migrants who have been arrested, who are still going through whatever the process is to determine whether they should be deported. And they figure, okay, we've got the facilities and we want to show that we are working with the feds. So we will do this for a dollar a year.
Have the feds said that this would be a useful facility for them?
Feds haven't said much of anything. I think they're still trying to figure out what they can and cannot do. You know, obviously, they've been deporting people. So that raised the question of, do you need an interim prison? I know that they're talking about some place to deal with folks who are in the process of debating whether they should be deported. But as you've also seen, they're making direct flights to countries in Central and South America. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of need for a place to house them in the interim.
Interesting. All right, Howie, let's move on to a House committee on Wednesday. This is a bill that's gotten a decent amount of attention since it was introduced. It would basically remove state prohibitions against having things like grenades and bombs and automatic weapons and things like that. But as you have said in the past, and you've written about this, this is more of a political statement than actually saying Arizonans who want to make bombs should be allowed to?
Pretty much. I mean, the fact is that much of this stuff is banned by federal law. You cannot possess a pipe bomb or an improvised explosive device. Curiously enough, some of the stuff that state law prohibits you from possessing right now actually is legal in some cases under federal law. You actually can get a license under federal law to have a machine gun. You can get a license under federal law to take some additional background checks to get a silencer. And yet they're absolutely illegal under state law. And what Alexander Culloden is saying is, look, I believe in the Second Amendment. I am an absolutist. You know, Congress, you know, the laws against the possession of weapons shall not be infringed. In fact, the Arizona law is even broader than the federal law, because, you know, remember, the federal Second Amendment talks about a well-regulated militia. Arizona's version of the Second Amendment says the right of individuals to defend themselves shall not be abridged. So he figures, look, we can't deal with the federal government. We can't tell the federal government what to do. But we can make sure that we are not complicit in something that infringes on Second Amendment rights. And so this becomes our way of doing it. Now, the other part of the politics of this is something that is going around the governor, who would probably veto it anyway.
Yeah.
It would go directly on the ballot in 2026. And that might bring out certain people who not just support this, but support other Republican causes. So there's a little bit of gamesmanship behind this.
All right. Howie, before we let you go, let me ask you about one other bill that will be coming up in a House committee on Wednesday that would stop cities from taxing groceries. This has been a big issue. I know when Phoenix was debating this a few years back, it seems like there are a few cities that still have grocery taxes.
Sure. Voters got rid of the tax years and years ago. They said the state should not be taxing groceries. The idea being, you know, these are necessities. You know, some states, in fact, don't even tax clothing as being necessities. Arizona's decision was, if you go to the grocery store, you buy a dozen eggs, although Lord knows you can afford it or not, you should not be paying the state's 5.6% tax.
Yeah.
But cities have their own taxes of, you know, up to 2, sometimes 3%. And they say they need that money to provide certain services. Well, this is a mirror of the fight that we had a year or so ago over rental taxes. You know,
right.
Some cities level rental taxes. The idea is, again, should cities be making money this way? Now, if in fact cities lose that revenue source, their argument is they will either have to cut services or tax something else. And those are the details to be worked out. Should they raise the taxes on other items, you know, to a higher level to make up for the food taxes?
Right. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration says its mass deportations are well underway. More than 8,000 immigrants were arrested in the first 2 weeks of the new term. 461 were released. It's not adding up to the, quote, millions and millions of deportations Trump promised on his inauguration day. And NBC News is reporting the president is angry the numbers aren't higher. But we are seeing signs of ramped up deportations here in Arizona, where an armored tank and dozens of federal agents arrived on a quiet Phoenix street to arrest a 61-year-old undocumented immigrant recently. It's the kind of political show our next guest says is far from normal. Lori Roberts is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and she joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning, Lori. Elvia?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Lori, begin for us by describing this operation in Northwest Phoenix recently. Like, they were after Alfonso Garcia Vega, who ICE says has been deported repeatedly, convicted of various offenses, illegal reentry, weapons offenses. It makes sense that he would be a target for deportation, yeah?
Yeah, it does make sense. They've said that they were going to start with violent criminals. I don't know that he's been convicted of any violent offenses, but he has been convicted multiple times and deported multiple times. So he would seem to be a target. So it's a Sunday morning on his West Phoenix street, and he's walking down the street, and two ICE officers attempt to get him to come over and talk with them. He does, I think, what a lot of immigrants have been told they're supposed to do, which is ignore the ICE agents and make a beeline for your front door. Mm. And so that's what he did. And he wouldn't open the door when they knocked on it. So they come back that afternoon, not just an ICE agent or two, but with an armored vehicle complete with a battering ram on the front and several dozen officers, agents, I guess you would call them, in their cars with lights flashing. The battering ram comes down through the loudspeaker. He's told, please come out with your hands up. They won't answer the door. They don't respond. Eventually, there are flashbang grenades, you know, those stun grenades that are thrown. And eventually he does surrender and come out. So they got their man, but they also sent a very strong message in that neighborhood, which is you better know that we're serious about this.
The Republic's Daniel Gonzalez talked to his son. What did he have to say about this man who was arrested in this way?
Well, he said his father came to the U.S. about 40 years ago, the first time, proceeded to build a life and have a family, has four U.S.-born children. Between his deportations, he said that he was deported the last time, I believe, in 2020, came back in 2023 because he was being threatened by the Sinaloa drug cartel. He kind of fudged on whether he thought his father had a criminal record, but he said he's got health issues and just wants to live out his life here. I don't think there's going to be a lot of sympathy for that. The real interest, to me at least, in this particular deportation was the level of response that ICE gave it, complete with the tank. And I don't think that I mentioned they also had somebody there from ICE filming this whole thing, which sort of ties into their whole national thing of, you know, Kristi Noem. Here's Kristi Noem on her horse with her cowboy hat at the border. And here she is in her bulletproof vest in New York during a thing. And every day ICE is putting out just this campaign of, we're out there and we're going to get you. So I think it tied in quite well to that.
Elvia, let me ask you about that and sort of the larger picture here. We've seen some workplace raids so far. We have seen, it seems, some ramping up in deportations. But we've also seen, as Lori's getting at there, sort of a lot of media around it. Is that the difference?
That's the difference, and it is made for that. Ordinary people and taxpayers should be incredibly concerned about all the money that is being spent on a show. I mean, this kind of deportation so far has been made for TV with multi-agencies, with tons of immigration and other enforcement officials just to detain one man who, even if he has a criminal record, clearly they could have taken him easily without that show. And as we know, producing a TV show is really expensive. So yes, they are absolutely sending the message that they are in business of deporting. And I believe President Trump just wants to show that to his people that he is doing it, that he is in fact ready to deport the millions of people that you mentioned there at the intro, regardless. And it's also a way to make sure that people are panicking, and clearly immigrants are very afraid, but also everyone else around it, right? They want people to snitch on immigrants. They want people to call the hotline.
Lori, will it, though, maybe deter people, encourage folks to self-deport? That must be part of the calculation.
Well, I think that's a big part of the calculation. For one thing, I don't think that they have a place to house all these millions upon millions of immigrants that they want to deport. They're really hoping to send the message, A, if you're thinking about coming here, don't. And B, if you're already here, you might as well just go ahead and go home, because otherwise I'm going to put you in Guantanamo Bay in some deep hole and nobody's ever going to hear from you again. I think those are the two messages that we hear most often, with the idea being that hopefully these people will pack up and go home, and then it won't cost us anything, and the show will be over. I mean, he's playing to two crowds here. One is his voters, and he undoubtedly was elected to do just what he's doing, and immigrants who are here, telling them, we will get you, we will find you, and you will find a tank on your front lawn if you don't just go ahead and save yourself the misery of all of this and self-deport.
There's absolutely no evidence that immigrants are afraid enough to self-deport. I mean, at least I don't see it. I don't see it in Arizona, and I don't see it anywhere, because, you know, returning to their native lands will be a lot worse than being here.
Elvia, what does it do, or what is it doing already, I guess, to immigrant communities? I mean, we saw Latinos vote for Trump in larger numbers than they had in the past, this past election. And now you're seeing, I'm sure, some fear among immigrant communities.
Well, there's no mistake that Latinos, and especially Latino men, voted for Donald Trump. And I have talked to some of them, and I've heard and I have seen what they say on social media, and they still believe that Trump is doing exactly what he promised he would do. And they believe that immigration went out of control. But at the same time, I hear a lot of fear, including from some of those Latinos and Latinas that voted for Trump and have relatives that are undocumented. Now they're very afraid for them because they naively thought that Trump was only going to target the criminals or the bad people, as they say. And so a lot of fear. We'll see what happens. I don't see that minimizing anytime soon.
Lori, let me ask you lastly about the reaction to this. You wrote about some of the reaction on social media to this particular story. Lots of people saying this is great, good job, well done. Do you think that there will be backlash at some point, like we saw, you know, under the first Trump administration when they started dividing families, things like that?
Oh, absolutely. At some point, they're going to trip themselves up. They're going to arrest the wrong person or they're going to deport a U.S. citizen. It's inevitable with a deportation program this widespread that something's going to go wrong in a high-profile fashion, and then people will start to say, you know, what are we going to do here? But I don't think it will happen anytime soon. Based on the reactions that I see from people, they not only cheered the bringing of a tank into this quiet neighborhood and the military-style operation, but they said, hey, all of his kids should go with him because they're here illegally too, which, of course, they're not. We have birthright citizenship in this country, but the mood is not one that is with any kind of sympathy for anyone who is here illegally at the moment. And I think it's going to just have to ride out. But pendulums swing, and this one will inevitably too.
We'll leave it there for now. That is Lori Roberts, columnist with the Arizona Republic's opinion pages, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about this story. Thank you both for coming on, as always. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, exploring the artistic freedom of the mermaid world.
But first, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appears to be on track to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate as Secretary of Health and Human Services after he won the approval of a committee last week on a party-line vote. He and the rest of the Trump administration have been talking about a number of health and health care-related issues, from vaccines to gender-affirming care to the future of Medicare and Medicaid. With me to talk about what the future may look like in the world of healthcare is James Hodge, a professor in ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy. And James, let's start broadly. What is most on your radar at this moment?
It is so many different fronts that are hitting us simultaneously, Mark. That's actually kind of hard to answer, but I'll be the first to say, listen, it's about leadership among some of the major federal agencies responsible for healthcare, public health, and other critical health services nationally. We still don't have those persons completely in place, but what we're seeing from the Trump administration is the chosen leaders for which Senate is working to confirm right now, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for HHS, will result in very systematic changes at these major federal agencies, and the impacts will affect all Americans.
So let's talk about Robert Kennedy Jr. I mean, and it looks as though his confirmation will be going ahead. So assuming that he does become HHS secretary, what areas, you mentioned a lot of potential changes, like what are some of the biggies to you that could sort of have the most widespread impact on people's day-to-day lives?
Among the premier issues you saw senators grill him over in relation to the confirmation hearings was, of course, vaccine policies going forward. He's made promises to senators of how he will actually take on vaccine issues more appropriately, more in line with public health measures. Those promises are ones we will have to see how far we can keep. But let's be clear on one thing. If he is actually put into place leading HHS, it's so much more than vaccines that's going to be at the front and center of our concerns. This individual did not express or show real significant understanding of even core basic health services done through HHS, like Medicare and Medicaid and other specific initiatives that do affect millions of Americans. Some of the ways in which those programs could change are really going to be watched heavily. And then there's the whole factor around misinformation, the types of data that will be allowed or not allowed for public to access and see on websites, all of which is under HHS purview. Some of those particular concerns, Mark, are at the highlight of our list.
Let me ask you about some of that data, because in some areas of government, you know, researchers and others who use that data have already talked about some of it missing from websites or databases. Are you seeing that already in terms of healthcare or, you know, anything coming from, you know, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services or any other sort of federal healthcare agencies?
Yeah, you bet. The amount of information already to date in the first week since this order came through the Trump administration that's been pulled from websites at CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Food and Drug Administration or agency, FDA, these specific sites have pulled data that matter a lot to researchers, to others working in these specific arenas, public health officials. The sort of purge of data around some really critical topic, including highly vulnerable populations that rely on these data, persons with HIV and others to that nature, has been systematic and just discouraging without doubt. Now, on the flip side, there are real significant legal challenges that have already been raised to those specific purges of data. There's every opportunity for some of that data to reappear. This is not a permanent fix, but rather the initial reaction to some of what has been offered up for how we will reposition health data to American public and to others as well globally. It's been quite profound. You've rarely seen a level of sort of rescission of data of this nature over many years accumulated, gone in a matter of hours.
Well, so you mentioned potential legal challenges. Given what you do for a living, how robust do you think those will be? I mean, how much time do you think federal courts will be spending over the next months and years, potentially, dealing with issues arising from what this administration does or tries to do in the world of healthcare?
Right. Mark, on the data front, for example, lawsuits already been filed to challenge some of what CDC and FDA have taken down off of their sites. Whether that lawsuit will be successful, of course, is months in the making. Mm-hmm. Let's be sure, one of the only opportunities that we're seeing available to persons, you know, objecting to some of these policies, and particularly how that may impact their personal health status, is through courts. So we're not seeing Congress step up to any of the plate. We're seeing federal agencies having to succumb to some of what the current administration is basically directing them to do. Courts remain that outlet. Multiple different lawsuits have already stopped in place. Multiple different President Trump sort of related initiatives that have had the potential to impact health. We're going to see more of that to come. But it relies on something, Mark, that's really quite pivotal. And that is just how far courts are willing to go to strike down initiatives of this nature.
So especially, you know, talking about things like Medicare and Medicaid that you mentioned earlier, I'm wondering what kind of impact the focus on reducing government spending might have on the way that healthcare is administered and maybe, you know, sort of even the legal landscape for how we think about and maybe litigate healthcare in this country.
You know it, Mark. Listen, very few Americans want to see government tinker with or touch much in relation to Medicare. Medicare's a fairly solid bet that it will retain its sort of essence of being a stable program, able to pay for those expenses for persons over age 65 or disabled persons who largely access Medicare benefits. But Medicaid is a whole nother story. That's the federal state program that states like Arizona through our access program and every other state relies on federal dollars to run, but also state dollars to actually pull off. Medicaid is subject to considerable refinements across states, but also at the federal level. You're already seeing congressional proposals to reinstitute things like work requirements for persons who are able to access Medicaid. In Arizona, this could result in tens of thousands of persons who would lose access to Medicaid if it were implemented on a federal basis as a requirement of the program. That falls on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. That's going to be potentially under the direction of someone, Dr. Oz, that we have no clear sense of how he would run that program. And of course, subject ultimately to a potential secretary, Robert Kennedy Jr., who couldn't even accurately explain the difference between those two programs during his Senate confirmation proceedings. If you're worried about what those future benefits of Medicaid might be, there's good cause for concern, without doubt.
It sounds like, I mean, just so much of what we think of now and what we have known as how this country's healthcare system has operated could be really, really different, even just, you know, within a year or two.
Within months, even, Mark. You know, I've described it before as whether or not the status quo of healthcare being for sale in the United States will continue under a Trump administration. And what I mean by that is, you know, we've always had great healthcare available in the United States if you can afford it or you can buy it. But we rely systematically for millions of Americans on federal and state funded programs that make that option available, including through the Affordable Care Act, which is clearly still on the chopping block as far as this administration. When you tinker with those programs, when you make even slight adjustments to them, when you remove essential health benefits that Medicaid will cover, or that you don't allow drug pricing to go forward through Medicare to lower the price of those drugs for seniors, you affect millions of persons' lives. I do predict those effects will start to be kind of realized in the next several months and throughout the entirety of the current administration.
All right. That is James Hodge with ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. James, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
My bet, Mark. Great a pleasure to speak with you as well.
History will remember last night's Eagles triumph in the Super Bowl as one of the more lopsided wins in the history of the big game. But as usual, just as many people are talking about the commercials as the final score. Tim Reister runs the firm Reister Advertising, and as he told the show's Sam Dingman, running a Super Bowl ad is a high-stakes gamble.
It's so important because all of the commercials around you are trying to be the most unique and ingenious messaging. They'll bring in sought-after talent like celebrities. And so when you create one of these commercials, you need to bring a much greater amount of discipline because the advertisement is not just appearing in front of so many people with one opportunity to succeed, but it's competing against so many other highly attractive messages.
Well, and it strikes me that you're going for a message that will resonate in the moment when it airs. But now there's this whole Super Bowl ad industrial complex that's sprung up around it. So there's going to be follow-up conversations like the one we're having. There's going to be, you drop them on YouTube a little bit ahead of time to get the conversation started. It just seems like there's so many factors that you're trying to take into account.
It's several weeks of fanfare leading up to this opportunity. And it's interesting because often the teasers that you see from brands aren't anywhere near what the actual – commercial will be on game day.
Right. There's like a trailer for the commercial.
Exactly. It's like a movie trailer just for a 30 or 60 second commercial.
So thinking back, prior to talking about the commercials from this year, any commercials from the last several years that really stick in your mind as particularly successful in taking all these factors we're talking about into account?
I think the first big one that broke through was Apple Computers when they first launched their brand. The commercial was called 1984.
Yeah.
And it was a play on George Orwell's book. And it was just this amazing image of all of these engineers sitting in a theater. And this lady comes in, swinging a hammer, one of these swinging tools that you see like in the Olympics, and she throws it up and shatters the screen and really conveys that something totally new in that high-tech industry was coming. And that changed the way people looked at the Super Bowl for advertising.
If I'm not mistaken, did Ridley Scott direct that commercial?
Yes. Excellent memory.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that to me is such an interesting moment in terms of kind of announcing this form as something worthy of creative discussion and critical debate. And now it's reached the point where that level of prestige has moved in front of the camera, right? And now it's like a competition. I mean, I feel like one of the leitmotifs in the Super Bowl every year is like, how many ads will Matt Damon be in and how many ads will Matt Damon be talked about in? So am I right that 1984 ad also kind of augured the arrival of mainstream celebrities taking this seriously as a medium?
It did, and so much so that as a viewer, I'd like to see more discretion.
Yeah.
Right? So last night, how many ads did we see with Matthew McConaughey?
Right.
Or Tom Brady?
Yeah.
I mean, the poor guy was in more ads, I think, than he had color commentary for the game.
Exactly. Okay. Well, so let's talk about last night. What for you were the highlights? What were the most successful ads?
There were lots of categories we could explore. I think the newest category was AI, and there were more commercials promoting AI than ever in the history of the Super Bowl. Only one of them was appealing to me, and that was Google Gemini. And it was a beautiful ad about how Google Gemini on the Google phone helped coach a person for a job interview, and it went through their life and how their experience as a father helped prepare them for all kinds of things in business.
Yes.
Well, it was a role where I learned to take constructive criticism.
I think she like, oh, nope, doesn't like it.
Okay. I got pretty used to, you know, working long hours with a small team.
That was beautifully done. Now, to answer the rest of your questions, the other categories that really caught my eye, cause-related issues.
Uh-huh.
There were more ads for cause-related issues this year, which I always love when people use the opportunity of the Super Bowl to make some positive change in our society. Novartis with their breast cancer commercial. I see you
looking at me. Really? Let's go.
Watch me. I thought it was extremely attention grabbing. And then it brought us to the point where, hey, we all are noticing breasts every day, but we ought to be thinking about the real issue that can help protect women, and that's early detection.
That was a pretty interesting one, I thought, additionally, because it also felt like, I mean, obviously there's a fixation with women's bodies in American culture, but the Super Bowl is that energy on steroids, generally speaking. So doing that in the midst of the Super Bowl felt particularly loaded.
I love that. I had goosebumps all over my arms when I saw that commercial and was so proud of them for using that opportunity. Another trick in the Super Bowl, in that 30-second opportunity, is how do you connect among all viewers?
Well, that makes me think about the Jeep ad, and I wonder what you felt about that one.
Freedom is the roar of one man's engine and the silence of another's. Freedom is the ability to inspire. The most sacred thing in life isn't the path. It's the freedom to choose it.
It definitely, the Jeep ad deserves an honorable mention. Harrison Ford is always amazing, right? He can deliver any script well. Their message was all about freedom, and I liked how they wove it into how this vehicle can help provide you freedom. And that's something that resonates to the older consumer because we can look back on that. But it's also really good advice to the younger consumers watching the
yes.
Super Bowl.
So just a couple more minutes here, Tim. We've talked about what these ads are really aspiring to. We've talked about the ones that pulled it off particularly successfully. What in your mind were some of the less successful attempts last night?
I was really disappointed in the Dunkin' commercial.
Yes. Okay. The Dunkings.
The Dunkings. First of all, I find it curious that they just focus on coffee when it was America's iconic donut brand.
Right.
Right. They were trying to take on Starbucks in this commercial, but it was loaded with so many different celebrities. It was packed with way too many jokes. And I found that it was extremely difficult to follow. Mm-hmm. And I think it flopped.
Well, especially since I feel like their kind of central joke was the idea that Jeremy Strong takes acting very seriously.
You're an artist, and I know what that's like, but how long is it going to take for the bean method?
I mean, I'll be ready in like 3 hours.
Which is largely well known because of a New Yorker profile from a couple of years ago, which is directly targeted at me as an audience. But I don't know how many people in the broader culture, you know, have recently reread that Michael Shulman profile from 2022 or whatever it was. So it's sort of an odd joke to sit really heavily in.
Insider jokes usually don't play well. And sometimes a memorable commercial can be a real flop because mm-hmm. they just don't have the judgment and discretion to do what would be appropriate for the audience. An example of that is a first-time advertiser in the Super Bowl this year, Coffee Mate.
Oh, dear.
And clearly they were trying to reposition the brand for a much younger audience. But the dancing tongue was so just disturbing and gross. Everyone at the party I attended when they were watching this, they were just like, oh, my gosh, that's hideous. And I think especially with a food product, you don't want to do something that's gross, even if it's memorable.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I would love to be a fly on the wall in the post-mortem meeting about that ad today. Well, Tim Reister is the head of Reister Advertising, joining us today for a post-mortem of our own on the Super Bowl ads from last night. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Artificial intelligence has become a big topic of conversation and in some cases concern worldwide. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, Paris is hosting an AI summit today and tomorrow. What's on the agenda?
Well, that's right. It's set against the backdrop of Paris's 125-year-old Grand Palais. Representatives from more than 80 countries, including world leaders, tech bosses, academics, and other experts, have gathered for a two-day summit to discuss current progress and future goals for the rapidly evolving, hugely disruptive technology that is artificial intelligence. And the summit comes at a really interesting time for the technology, largely because of the excitement caused by China's rival to services like ChatGPT, known as DeepSeek. It gives an answer that's almost as good, if not better, than some of its rivals, as long as you don't ask about controversial topics in China, such as Tiananmen Square or the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, discussion of which can be heavily censored. But the firm behind it claims it was created at a fraction of the cost and with much less computing power than some of its Western rivals, though there has been some reporting recently casting a bit of doubt on those claims. However, it made a significant dent in the share price of other major players in the AI space. Officials from Emmanuel Macron's office have described this summit as a, quote, wake-up call for France and Europe, adding that the bloc must not let the AI revolution pass it by. The summit has also attracted some heavy hitters, with US Vice President J.D. Vance attending, as well as the head of OpenAI, Sam Altman, and Google's Sundar Pichai. Elon Musk is notably absent from the guest list, but he'll no doubt have things to say about it in any case.
And Jonathan, this is the third summit of its kind, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The first was held in Bletchley Park in the UK back in November 2023. And then there was a follow-up summit in South Korea in May of last year. The first summit had the word safety in its title. That doesn't play such a central role this time around, but concerns around safety are most certainly on the agenda. One issue to have emerged in the last week, for example, is that Google's parent company, Alphabet, has lifted a long-standing ban on artificial intelligence being used for developing weapons and surveillance tools. Human Rights Watch criticized that decision, telling the BBC AI could, quote, complicate accountability for battlefield decisions that it says may have life or death consequences. Now, experts say AI could be widely deployed on the battlefield, though there are obviously fears about its use, particularly with regard to autonomous weapons systems. Concern is greatest over the potential for AI-powered weapons capable of taking lethal action without human supervision, with campaigners arguing controls are urgently needed. Now, originally, long before the current surge of interest in the ethics of AI, Google's founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page said their motto for the firm was "Don't be evil." Back in 2015, that motto switched to "Do the right thing." And since then, Google staff have sometimes pushed back against the approach taken by their executives. Back in 2018, the firm did not renew a contract for AI work with the US Pentagon, following resignations and a petition signed by thousands of employees. They feared so-called Project Maven was the first step towards using artificial intelligence for lethal purposes, though that may now have taken a back seat. And it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out in the coming day or so.
Yeah, that will be interesting. All right, so Jonathan, later this week, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi will be visiting President Trump in the White House. What do you expect to be on the agenda for their conversations?
Well, it's pretty notable, isn't it, that a visit from the strongman leader of India, Narendra Modi, has been prioritized over visits from leaders of some of America's traditional European allies like France, Germany, or Britain. Now, of course, we saw that visit from Benjamin Netanyahu last week to the White House, where Donald Trump suggested the US could take over Gaza and turn it into what he called the Riviera of the Middle East. Narendra Modi and Donald Trump shared warm relations during the US president's first term. They had what was described as a productive phone call a week or so ago, discussing illegal immigration, security, and trade ties, according to the White House. Last year, Donald Trump described Narendra Modi as a great leader, but also accused India of charging excessive tariffs. And so analysts say it'll be interesting to see if the bonhomie between the two men will help overcome concerns about trade and immigration. And given Mr. Trump's love of using tariffs as a tool of international diplomacy, I'm sure trade is going to be one of the key issues on the agenda for the talks this week. So far, India has escaped the threat of blanket tariffs on its exports to the US, but Donald Trump previously called India a tariff king and a big abuser of trade ties and threatened reciprocal action if Delhi did not reduce taxes on US imports. India's recent budget did, in fact, see duties slashed on a range of American goods, including high-end motorcycles like the iconic Harley-Davidson. At the time, India's finance secretary told local media this was a sign that the country was indeed not a tariff king.
Sure. So, Jonathan, another gathering coming up this weekend. Leaders from around the world will be getting together for the Munich Security Conference. Why is this one important?
Well, the Munich Security Conference is a forum established back in 1963 in a Cold War quest for peace and prosperity. Delegates discussed the major security challenges facing the world, and it's seen as the leading global gathering on defense matters at a time when security issues are obviously high on everyone's agenda. Russia used to be on the guest list, but its invitation was rescinded in the wake of its full-scale of invasion of Ukraine almost 3 years ago. The United States is sending the Vice President, J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and Keith Kellogg, who's the U.S. Special Envoy for Ukraine and Russia. No doubt one of the issues up for discussion will be the recent progress on the conflict in the Middle East, with a ceasefire and hostage release deal in place between Israel and Gaza, at least for the time being. It remains to be seen, however, whether that ceasefire can be extended beyond the initial six-week period. And of course, as I said earlier, Donald Trump's suggestion in last week that the U.S. could take over the Gaza Strip with the Palestinians currently living there moved elsewhere could well have significantly complicated the talks towards a more lasting peace. The idea has been rejected by countries in the region, such as Jordan and Egypt and key U.S. allies, while the U.N. issued a warning against, quote, any form of ethnic cleansing.
Well, and speaking of Ukraine, Donald Trump promised to end that war if he was reelected. Is there likely to be any progress toward that goal at this weekend's gathering, Jonathan?
I mean, it's hard to say. As you say, Donald Trump pledged during the presidential campaign to end the war in Ukraine immediately following his return to the White House. Shortly before he returned to the presidency, that pledge was downgraded to a desire to end the fighting within 6 months. For the time being, the U.S. is continuing its support of Ukraine with weaponry, though for how much longer is a big question. Much hinges on a blueprint from the U.S. government said to be being prepared on how the conflict should be brought to a close. There were some media reports last week that Donald Trump's Ukraine envoy, Keith Kellogg, would be presenting the U.S. his proposals to end the war at this weekend's Munich Security Conference. Now, in an interview with Newsmax, Keith Kellogg confirmed that the only person who will be presenting such a plan is the president himself. But it may be that we get a sense of what proposals could feature in the plans. And Donald Trump told reporters on Air Force One over the weekend that he had recently spoken with Russia's president. Now, Vladimir Putin has said repeatedly that he's prepared to negotiate an end to the war, but that Ukraine would have to accept the reality of Russian territorial gains, which are currently about 20% of its land. He also refuses to accept Ukraine joining the Western military alliance NATO. Kyiv doesn't want to give up its territory, although President Zelensky has conceded he may have to cede some currently occupied land temporarily. He's going to be at the security conference this weekend. Now, it's not clear that Donald Trump necessarily believes Ukraine should get its territory back, and some military experts believe he may prioritize an end to the fighting over ensuring territorial integrity for Ukraine. That leaves open the possibility that should a ceasefire begin, Vladimir Putin would have another attempt to take the country at some point down the line. So there are high-stakes discussions to be had in Munich this weekend.
Absolutely. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now let's dive into the underwater world of real-life mermaids.
This is a $500 million industry. There are pageants, there are conventions, there are competitions, there are auditions, there are shows.
Wait, that's a job? I always wanted to be a mermaid.
I get emails all the time from people telling me that they want to be a professional mermaid, and my first thought is, oh, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into.
That is from a Netflix documentary series that explores the people who work as professional mermaids. They perform in tanks in the ocean and in pageants, wearing fins and seashells and coral, suspending reality and oxygen while they do it. So today, let's meet Arizona's top mermaid. Really, Michelle Mosden won Miss Mermaid Arizona in 2021. And yes, that is a real competition. An attorney by day, she's performed at the Renaissance Festival at Atlantis in the Bahamas and was featured in the title sequence for that Netflix documentary. And it's all no easy feat. She is a lifelong competitive swimmer with multiple certifications in free diving and open water scuba, because, as she told me, mermaiding is not for the faint of heart.
It is a danger art. When you are in a tank, when you are out in the ocean or any kind of environment like that, you are diving down to depth and performing on extended breath holds. Mm-hmm. So you have to be incredibly comfortable and experienced in the water. Also, when you're swimming with animals, with sea creatures, right. Other fish, it's important to be aware of your surroundings and understand that you are still in their environment, and you just need to be respectful of the situation and the environment that you're in.
So tell us about that. Like, have you swam with fish, sharks, things like that? Things that are dangerous?
Yes. I have swam with sharks before. They really just mind their own business. They don't want to eat me, but it's still important to be aware of because animals are unpredictable.
So talk about the extended breath holds thing you mentioned. Like, I wonder this, because if you watch videos of people doing this, it really seems as if they are breathing underwater, but obviously you're not doing that. How does it work?
Right. So I am freediving level one certified. I'm working on a level two certification. I think having that sort of background and training lets you know how to do a proper breathe up and lets you understand and explore your own limits, your own capacity, and that way you're able to actually do this safely.
Like, how long do you usually hold your breath underwater when you're doing these performances?
So when I'm it sort of depends on the sets. When I was working at the Arizona Renaissance Festival, they would have hour-long sets, and my standard breath hold would be maybe a minute 20 to a minute 30 under, and then coming up for about 30 to 45 seconds on top to recover and do another breathe up before going down again. But my best dynamic breath hold would, and dynamic means you're moving, you're doing some activity underwater, is a little bit over 2 minutes.
Wow. I want to also ask about the artistic side of this, or like the passionate side of this, because you must really love it to do it as sort of a, it's a profession for you, but sort of a side profession, right? I mean, what does it feel like when you're doing this, when you're in that costume, when you're in the water, especially if you're kind of around fish or sharks or like really in these very realistic environments, right?
Yeah. And so maybe I think maybe the best way to answer this is to sort of go back. I started off playing in the water. Like, I was always, you know, wanting to spend every opportunity I could playing whales, playing dolphins, and then eventually mermaids with my friends during the summer. Mm-hmm. And finally, my parents were just like, we can't keep you out of the water. Let's just do something productive with all of that time. And you're on a swim team now. Yeah. And I was like, great, this is so much fun. But I think as you sort of get into that competitive world, the joy sort of, at least in my experience, I think I lost the joy for it. Because when you're training 7,000 yards, you know, twice a day, 6 days a week, that's exhausting. And you sort of lose sight of, or at least I feel like I did, lost sight of, what am I doing this for? Who am I doing it for? Mm-hmm. And eventually I ended up getting a back injury that kept me out of the water for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I think coming back into the sport with a different mindset and now swimming as an adult, I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it because I enjoy being in the water and I enjoy what that experience has to offer. And I think for me, the appeal of mermaiding, it's really another way to just explore my passion for the water in a different context of relationship.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of come full circle for me. Mm. It's play, it's artistic freedom, it's being able to just kind of make fun shapes with your body. The mermaid tails that I like to swim in have a large carbon fiber monofin encased inside them. So you can get a lot of power with not a lot of effort. Mm. And it's really kind of just the act of being able to slow down, enjoy the scenery around you, and do it in a way where you're maybe feeling a little bit magical.
A little bit magical. There is something magical about it, right? Like, I wonder that, like, if you can kind of give us a peek into the world of this, not just your own experience, but like, you won Miss Mermaid Arizona. There are competitions for this. This is a big kind of lucrative industry. Lots of people are involved in this. Lots of people kind of call themselves mer people. Tell us a little bit about the broader world that this exists in.
I originally decided to enter this or to compete in this pageant because I thought it was going to be a lot more swimming than it actually was. But it was not so much swimming, but it was a really interesting opportunity to be able to connect with all of these other incredible mermaids and merpeople from around the country and even the world, who have incredible platforms. And just hearing other platforms and seeing the activism on the environmental front that all of these other mermaids are active in.
Yeah. You're also an attorney, right? Like, this is not your only career. It's sort of a side hustle for you, right? I mean, yes. I wonder, is that true for most people who do this as a profession? Like, is it hard to make a full-time living doing this kind of work?
Absolutely. The concept of a full-time professional mermaid exists for maybe, I can count on like on one hand, mm-hmm. the number of people that I know who do this as a full-time career. And it's not all performance. If you want to do, say, mermaiding as a career, you have multiple revenue streams. You're teaching mermaid classes through like a scuba or freediving certification agency and certifying individuals or instructors to be teachers themselves. You're creating content. You're maybe selling merchandise in addition to performance, because it really isn't something that you can do as a full-time performance career.
Do you feel as you're performing or as you're kind of practicing or doing this in the costume and in the tank or in the ocean, do you ever feel like you really are this mythical creature that you probably wish existed?
So I don't have any delusions about my actual anatomy, but there's a lot of individuals who do perform and who like to create what they call a mersona, which is, you know, mm-hmm. a character that you are portraying. And that was never really like an appeal or a draw for me, because mm-hmm. my mermaid self is really just kind of me, but in a tail. but it is fun when you are down there and performing and being able to bring that performance art to starstruck audiences or to children or even adults who are like, okay, is she okay? Is she gonna come up soon?
Is she gonna come up soon? Is right.
right. If there's, you know, I really do enjoy bringing that, you know, suspension of reality to the audience so that they can wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That is Michelle Mosden, an attorney and a professional mermaid performer, joining us to talk more about this world. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for giving us a glimpse here. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.